Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Manga Talks TV. This is a reaction podcast. We are giving our reactions, giving our feelings to Season 2, Episode 7 of House of the Dragon. Spencer, what did you think?
I liked it. I liked it more as the episode went on. By the time we got to the ending scenes of pretty much when the moment we were setting up Firmathor and the dragon seeds and the entire process of that, going through Ulf's joyride, I was practically standing and cheering. I was enjoying it so much. Before that, it was a little meandering. There were some scenes I liked more than others, and there's some decisive changes to the books I'll be interested to discuss with you in terms of character motivations, of where the show seems like it's interested in exploring a few themes and it's having characters step into those roles in a way that I think that could be interesting, but it's decidedly different. So I was adapting to those, but again, my enjoyment only increased as the episode went on, and by the time we got to the end of it, I was in a very happy mood.
Yeah, I feel like they were having to do like some heavy plot lifting this episode. They had to get Daemon to Harrenhal, to the Riverlands, get him an army, get Rhaenyra additional dragons. So introducing the concept of the dragon seeds, going through the process. There was a lot to do. And so they've churned through it basically. And now I feel like the table's really set for an interesting finale and an all systems go season three. So. You know, there's been some complaints about the season going a little slow for people, but I feel like any story that has big epic moments has to earn those moments, and you earn them through explaining the plot, explaining the characters, and getting there. And season two has done a lot of that. I have not been bored during it. Like the people who say they're bored, I don't understand. That's not my opinion, but. I do feel like a lot of this has been necessary to get to moments that are coming. That being said, if you're sitting around just waiting for dragon battles, it's like maybe just check the clips. Just check that on YouTube because this is a show. Like they are telling a story. That's not just like, you know, like dragon fighting on like a reality TV network.
And again, to a certain degree, as we discussed last episode, that's an issue of built-in expectations following the last couple seasons of Game of Thrones, which were really marketing themselves on spectacle, built around spectacle. This is a show that its spectacle is earned. It is a building up and plotting and movement of pieces that makes everything feel very natural, makes everything feel appropriately built up to and set up, that I really appreciate because it makes it come across as much more invested, much more engrossed in it than I would be if it's just a series of impressive images that are on the screen. It has meant that it means that the show, pound for pound, has fewer necessarily impressive images, as it were, than some of the last seasons of Game of Thrones, but my overall level of enjoyment is leagues higher than Game of Thrones at that point.
Yeah, and it's tough, right, because I think that a lot of people have adopted the narrative that the season is slower, there's less big moments happening. But then I feel really bad for the people who make the show, because I think undoubtedly people are going to say there was none of those big, epic, whatever moments this episode. However, they did burn like 20 people. Like, so the whole scene with Vermithor just like wrecking shop on the dragon seeds had to be, from a production standpoint, as difficult or more difficult than some of the big battle scenes that we see. So they're putting time, money, and effort into it. And I think they're telling a worthy story. You know, Vermithor is called the Bronze Fury. Vermithor is supposed to be terrifying. He's supposed to be a very scary dragon. Even among dragons, Vermithor is one of the scariest. And it adds to that mythos about Vermithor that when the dragon seeds were brought before him, he attempted to kill every single one until one of them just stood and screamed in his face. And
which
that's the only
that
thing
that
got his
name.
That's the only thing that got Vermithor's attention. Like the book obviously doesn't detail how Vermithor came about, Vermithor
was
agreed
claimed.
To. Yeah, agreed to the claim of Hugh, right? Like there was never any explanation of like what triggered that. I like what they've added in the canon, which is that it was what Vermithor was looking for is somebody with some spine, standing up and showing some toughness, right? And that was born out of desperation, but it was perfect that that moment happened, and it fits perfectly with the lore and the canon of Vermithor, and it fits well with what the show has established about how desperate and how out on a limb Hugh is, right? So that's something that backstory with Hugh is really important. Why would he stand in front of Vermithor, who's just burned 20 people alive? Why would he do that? Well, this is the end of his rope. He is this desperate, and that's why he did it.
We've also seen a generosity of generosity and a courageousness in the character in terms of supporting his family, in terms of speaking up for other members of his guild, and His act of standing up to Vermithor here was to protect another person. Vermithor was about to incinerate that woman that he'd just been hiding behind a rock behind, and he basically said, no, fuck it, come here, take me, I'm here right now. And as you said, that element of courageousness, that element of bravery, of sheer determination, of willing to basically shout down the dragon, clearly that's what the Bronze Fury was looking for. Whether Hugh had any means of knowing that, God knows, but he tapped into it perfectly. Silverwing, see, that's one of the more, unpack.
See, that's one of the more interesting things that I'll want to talk about long in the full recap that we'll do on Wednesday is, sure, there was this sort of immediacy of, I just asked this person to hide on the rock with me, and then the person ran, and then it looks like Vermithor is going to kill the person, so I've run over there to try to help. Sure. But what gets a person in a mindset that they're willing to throw their body in front of this dragon?
Desperation.
In this situation, right? Like, so he comes into the situation desperate, and it plays out with these instincts that he has to protect other people. So that character is working for me. Hugh is really working. Ulf, a little less so. Ulf is a sot. He's just a drunk in the book. And I can't tell if he's just a drunk here or just sort of a, you know, sort of a lazy dude, because he seems to just hang around all day. They don't show him like openly drunk. Like, he just seems to be constantly drinking and sort of not interested in doing much else. Right. So that's a little confusing. I'm not compelled by him when he's on screen. However, Silverwing's decision to allow Ulf to claim her, I am very, very interested. I want to talk about that, but from the dragon's perspective, I'm not too interested in Ulf, but like, what was going on in Silverwing's head?
Yeah, we'll talk about that long when we get there for the longer recap, but I'm actually rather invested in Ulf. And reading the chatter online and watching how my girlfriend reacted to him, Ulf's got some fans because he's an element of comic relief and the everyman that the show otherwise kind of lacks. Of where people are invested in him because he is just kind of a dude in a world of titans. And that seems like it's resonating to a certain degree. So, like, when Vermithor was wrecking shop, my girlfriend was laser-focused where Ulf was at any given moment because she was invested in making sure he's okay. And when he got knocked over the side, she actually gasped. And reading some early chatter online, some people reacted in the same way, were outright cheering when Ulf was on his joyride. So I think he actually does have some fans, but for very different reasons than Hugh.
I don't know how I feel about you giving street cred to your girlfriend's opinion by saying you've checked out some early chatter online about it.
On the Reddit right now. I'm reading as I'm talking to you.
Yeah, I don't know. I've not heard a lot of Ulf love. Not this character. Doesn't say it doesn't exist. That's not to say it doesn't exist. But regardless, my opinion is different, obviously. I find his scenes like a little out of place and, at times, maybe not like too silly, but just sort of boring. Not necessarily with the world. If we're looking for the everyman, that Hugh has done that for me. And I like the idea that his story has also explained, or showed a representative case of the effect of the blockade on King's Landing. So he'd served multiple purposes. And then we get to this fantastic in ramp with his character, which is like, oh, actually we were just building that he was just going to claim Vermithor. It's fantastic. You and I've talked on the podcast because we don't want to spoil that he was going to claim Vermithor, right? We've talked on the podcast about what is this character doing. And at first we were just kind of like, can't spoil it, but it's kind of obvious. And then the last couple episodes have been like, well, wait a second. He's serving double duty here because this is also talking about
perspective.
We're seeing the effect of the blockade on King's Landing, the growing frustration with Aegon Aemon's rule, and the rise of the small folk.
Loss of their daughter, apparently, which is interesting that happened off screen. It seemed like there was an element of almost like a time jump that was now that we're now realizing occurred between, not necessarily the last episode and this one, because we jump real fast between Dragon Rider to Dragon Rider confrontation on a beach, but maybe in the episode before that, because Aegon's healed quite a bit. Their daughter died off screen. Things have happened that suggest a passage of time that wasn't as immediately apparent, I guess.
You're suggesting that maybe they don't keep to a very strict sense of time in the show, and that could affect how they deal with the plot in later plot elements. Interesting. You brought that up.
This was an element I was annoyed about early on in this episode as I was suddenly realizing what has previously been a pretty regular day after day after day pace to things. Suddenly I was like, Aegon's walking, and you and I specifically said that was one of the things that couldn't happen this season and be realistic. Now, he's not walking great, sure, but there was suggestion like he's been going a lot of treatments, he's been working hard at this. There was a lot of suggestion in this episode that we missed a week or two in there somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, as your television buddy, I think where I've seen you get in trouble is when you're toward the end of the season or midway through a season and you go, well, because of X, Y, Z, this can't happen this season.
I'm always like, yes,
hang tight. Like, you
like, can't happen. Can't happen.
Yeah, because maybe, but like, they may just do it and they may have some like on screen explanation for it, right? Like with Aegon walking or whatever else. I agree with you that the time has gotten a little murky here, unless you want to say, and if you want to, we can make this canon on the show, that Rhaenyra chased Adam for 2 weeks. No. We can do that if you'd like to.
I'm not doing it.
I enjoy it.
I would agree that probably like a week or so passed within this episode in terms of recruiting the dragon seeds and bringing them to Dragonstone and setting up everything that occurred there.
Yeah.
Obvious passage of time happened there. But again, the episode is suggesting some events at some point over the last three episodes jumped a week or two. And that's fine. I'm adjusting. But I was kind of liking how steady the pace was of events occurring for the episodes leading up to this.
Yeah, you're so, like, at your heart, you're just a born and bred book is better person. So, like, the chronology of events is, like, important. Because yeah, you're a book reader, of course. Like, that's what gets established in the books, right? And it's funny because if you talk to people who are TV viewers first and book readers second, there's more hand waving, not completely, right? Like, it can't be egregious. Like, Game of Thrones got pretty egregious in some of the time jump stuff, but like, there is a little more hand waving with a primarily television audience. My opinion is that it probably betrays that you're more of a book reader than a lot of the TV stuff. And it bugs, I'm not saying it doesn't bug me either. I'm just psychoanalyzing you, which I know you enjoy.
You say that, but the show itself has differed remarkably from the books. I say books, one book and two novellas in terms of like overall experience of what we know about this story. Partly because we just don't have that much material to work from anyway. But this episode in particular was emphasizing scenes of classism, was emphasizing scenes of genetics, with Jace being the one who in the books is the one who pushes the dragon seed idea. He's actually the one that kind of puts it forward, whereas here they focused on the fact that he would be uncomfortable with that because it in many ways undermines his own legitimacy, that those who are merely just bastards who have any inkling of Targaryen blood can be dragon riders, whereas for him that was the basis of his authority to rule as her heir. That's an interesting thing from the Explorer, but would you agree it's pretty damn different from how they went with the character of Jace in the book?
I have a question for you. When he started in on Rhaenyra, like, these are mongers, yeah, did you think this was, oh, look, they're going to sully Jace just a tad because they've made him too perfect? Or did you immediately connect that he would feel like his position is undermined because he himself is a bastard?
This is the inherent pessimism of my soul. I thought it was going to be A, but was holding out hope for B, and I'm glad they went the B route because that works. It's different.
Yeah, it does.
Unquestionably different. But it works for a thematic aspect that I can understand for this character. And if they want to explore that further, fine. I'm with them on that. If it was just pure classism, I would be like, oh, come on. Yeah, sure, you can hit that if you want with Jace, but Jace feels like he's an odd one to pick for it.
Can I nominate something for chicken shit cutaway that wasn't a cutaway? I know it sounds bizarre. Chicken shit cutaway that wasn't a cutaway. So for those new to the podcast, Spencer and I occasionally will call out what we think are chicken shit cutaways in shows where they set up something we want to hear more about and then they just bail on it. And that kind of happened in the Jace Rhaenyra conversation where Jace bows up to her and goes, did you know I'd have black hair? Like, did you think this thing through before you were fucking hard and strong? And she stood up and she just went, I'm going to change the subject. And I was like, how could we get, can we get one conversation where Rhaenyra talks about this, like, openly? Like, you would think to anyone, she didn't even seem angry that he brought it up or offended or anything. Yeah. You would think that that would be the space that they could give that character to actually explain what her thought process was. We don't get it in the book, the novellas. We haven't gotten it in the show so far. I think it was our last chance to get what her actual thought process was in fathering these children with Harwin Strong.
It was interesting because you and I, since they were so willing to have Jace talk about it with other people or have it implied, whatever else, you and I kind of thought, also Rhaenyra to a certain degree too, in terms of like, you know, suggestions or winks or nudges of where, you know, well, we'll turn to people with other Targaryen blood. How will we know they'll be dragon riders? And Jace is looking at her like, right here, mom. to a degree that you and I were pondering, okay, well, that conversation just kind of happened off camera somewhere, and the two of them are open about it. This episode turned hard in the other direction of where it was, like, acknowledged between them, but never discussed. And this was the first inkling of a conversation that they were now openly having on the topic of it. And I'm with you. I want that conversation to take place, but as you said, it's not really a chicken shit cutaway. It's more that Rhaenyra was chicken shit in terms of not wanting to have the conversation.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a relative of the chicken shit cutaway, because it's not a cutaway, but it is the writers doing the same thing. It's the writing group doing the same thing, which is like, how about you guys put pen to paper and do two paragraphs from Rhaenyra on what was going on during that thing,
It's interesting because you and I talked about that Rhaenyra and Jace's relationship was rewarding and it was particularly close, and he was one of her key trusted advisors. The show's been going, I don't necessarily know in the opposite direction, but pulling at the threads of that for the last few episodes and showing that there is no small amount of tension that is forming between them. In part because, and this was an interesting decision on the Rhaenyra's part, she's no longer even attending council meetings. We talked about Aemon ruling by decree. Apparently, Rhaenyra is not particularly interested in actually going to her own council meetings to talk with her advisors anymore either.
So I didn't take that. I took it as she didn't attend that one after she'd just gotten back on Syrax.
We'll see if it's a trend.
And I mean, I think that my understanding of that was I was just fucking chasing down Sea Smoke. Like, I'm not going to come sit here. Yeah. And also, like, any decision I'm making about dragon riders is not, I'm not going to bring that to the council. You guys aren't dragon riders. I didn't take that to mean she's not going to go to council meetings ever again.
We'll see next episode of whether this is council.
I also think, look at you assuming the worst in Rhaenyra. You just assume.
I assume the worst in everyone. This is a trend in me.
Miss one class. Never going to class again. F.
Oh, yeah. Cut him right there.
Bart Simpson in detention. That's Rhaenyra next episode. Hey, I have so Rhaenyra, Jace, and their tension, it also makes sense to me that that's the one that's persisting for at least this reason. There's a bunch of reasons, but at least this reason, that when she brought Corlys in, Corlys can tighten up that group, and we saw examples of that.
Plainly
he
has.
He can't tighten up Jace. That's the one person on the council that he can't, like even Bela, he can potentially leverage his relationship with her. I don't know quite how it works with the relative rankings, but I'm not sure she's heads and shoulders above the Corlys and the Hand of the Queen in that organization. The heir, however, Jace, I don't think that Corlys has the same leverage.
It's kind of like an independent connection. He's not really right in the hierarchy as such.
To really buck him. And so you notice when he was telling the rest of the group, like, we'll do whatever, you know, she wants, and we're going to listen to it first before we make up our minds. He was pointedly looking at Bartimos Keldegard and other people in the room.
Everybody but Jace.
He was not in conversation with Jace during that. It seemed like he was barking orders to everybody but him. So that he also can't smooth that over. And it does look like he's trying to do some of that for her on the council, which I like that. I didn't want Corlys to show up to the council meetings and immediately fly hot with Rhaenyra again or immediately start fucking up. Corlys is a very skilled, adept, professional person in this world. I want him to show up and do a good job for a little while. That seems like what he's doing.
It was interesting that part of the reason that he kind of shut up the room and deferred to Rhaenyra was also that he was covering up aspects of his own, I'll just say sin for the sake of having a word for it, but the fact that he's quite aware of Adam of Hull's parentage, but for not sure voicing such out loud.
What did you think of the interaction of Adam when he got... the interaction with Rhaenyra and then we got back to Dragonstone. How did you feel about all that?
I love the differences in the motivations behind her three new dragon riders, of where each of is coming to this from a very different set of reasons and a very different perspective. And focusing on Adam, we've seen before that he is the one that's most focused on his own individual advancement. He's been a character that's been harping to his brother constantly about, we can use this. We can use our connections, we can use our family, we can use, you know, our bloodline, whatever else, to advance ourselves, to gain prestige and rewards and money and everything else. And so there was very little debate in my mind on that beach that when, you know, Rhaenyra comes and says, you know, who are you loyal to? He's immediately going to go, you, give me stuff, I want things, this is my ticket to fame, this is my ticket to ride right here. And that's what we've kind of seen out of his character from the word go.
So yes, right? And like so much of the character decisions happen in the way that I'm about to describe. Like this just happened with Hugh, where now let's go back to Adam. Mm-hmm. Adam, you're right. They have set the character up to show he has all of the, like this personal ambition and he mm-hmm. wants to go into war. He sees it as an opportunity, a way to move up. But he also is working for the Valyrians. He also is loyal to his brother, potentially his daddy. He hasn't talked too much about how he feels about Corlys, but definitely to his brother, Alan, who very much still works with the Valyrians. I also think like he is built, he was already going to be loyal to Rhaenyra because of situation and circumstance, and that decision gets reinforced with what we know about his personality and his individual personal ambition.
And that's one of the things Missandei was kind of trying to browbeat Rhaenyra on to a certain degree, of Rhaenyra was trying to say, oh, can we trust these lowborn? You know, they're not sworn to us. They don't have these fealty connections these noble houses do. Her point is like, no, they're sworn to you. No, they're connected to you. And if anything, you can trust them more because they're all the more dependent on you than these other lords that, as you are well aware, are fickle in their loyalties, see data point of your two half-brothers. So it was an important conversation on her part, as you said, tying the fact, hey, this guy is working for House Valyrian. He's always been working for House Valyrian. He is sworn to House Valyrian to the point that his first conversation with his bastard father is to ask to be removed from that service so he can transition to a different category of service. There are feudal reasons by which these lowborn would also potentially be loyal followers of you because they've been in your service already. They've just been beneath your notice.
Apropos of nothing, I kind of enjoyed when Rhaenyra and Jace were talking and Rhaenyra was like, well, what the fuck do you want me to do? Huh? You want me to fly out and fight Vhagar, or are you going to do it on Vermax? And as soon as she said that, they cut back to Jace, and Jace went, no. He did a, like, individual head shake, like, just to himself, like, no, I ain't doing that shit. That was pretty funny.
Well, I mean, his refrain last episode was, you know, let's call Daemon, let's count on Daemon and his army. But it's notable this episode, he seems like he learned his lesson, and that's not even a point he's going to try to raise to her. It's such a live wire issue for
Daemon, Daemon, Daemon. Yeah, she did bark at him. How about this question? Do you think that the fate of the Dragon Riders, not the two that were successful, but the 20 others.
And guards and everybody else, sure.
Is going to be a problem for Missandei.
It is curious to ponder because it was definitely an understood risk among at least part of the crowd. I would ask whether each of those commoners fully understood what they were signing up for in terms of the risks of walking into that room at that given time. I don't think Rhaenyra herself fully understood necessarily the risk, given that that was an interesting scene as well, that her dragon tamers effectively, I don't think they quit, but I think they basically went on strike for this particular operation in terms of willing to participate. Is that kind of vibe you got?
It's like on the Mangum Talks podcast network, when we're doing pods, it's great. And then I'm like, Spencer, we're going to review Rings of Power. And you stand before me with your staff and your robe and you say, I will not participate in this activity. I leave, and then you come back for House of Dragons Season 3. That's my – like, I feel like when Rhaenyra needs to get off Cyrax, they're going to be right back to take Cyrax in. Yeah. They're just not going to do this particular thing. Which, by the way, like, very much an organization where it feels like probably should go on strike and not quit. Like, I don't know what other job as Dragon Keeper you're going to get, like, anywhere. So, like, probably need to stick with House Targaryen.
Man, credit to Rhaenyra, she kind of, I don't know, proving them useless is going way too damn far in terms of the roles they play, but in terms of calling and taming dragons, good God, was that a power move that she had with Vermithor, of where she just, no singing, no ceremony or anything else, which I think she's gotten to a certain degree distrustful of now that what she's personally experiencing, she basically just said, it's like she whistled for her cat to come inside at the end of the day of, Here, Vermithor, come here, I got a treat for you. Vermithor comes right away, very peaceable with her. She just puts a hand on him and then turns her back for a shot that they've been, you know, I'm sure going to use for many a trailer in the future.
I'd like to go long-winded on the pod about why Vermithor allowed Rhaenyra to do that and why Rhaenyra felt safe, relatively safe, walking up to Vermithor and touching Vermithor. I don't know the answer to that. I have some theories, but like that stands out to me. But the Dragon Keeper specifically. So they introduced the idea in season one of this show that the Dragon Keepers actually helped the young princes bond, learn how to bond with the dragon. Yes. That was never my impression of their role from the books or anything I've read in the supplemental materials. I think that is something that Ryan threw in season one. That's an important part of their scope to differentiate it, though, because I always thought that the bonding of the dragons was knowledge that was kept in House Targaryen, that was that was passed within the family. And the Dragon Keeper's role was valet. Like they park the car when you bring it in. They make sure they're fed. They take care of them. Think the guy with the Rancor in Empire Strikes Back.
The guy that cries.
Return of the Jedi. Yeah. When comes in and he takes care of the Rancor, right? Like he feeds and waters
the
and all of that.
Room. Yeah.
That's why they were always called Dragon Keeper, not Dragon Trainer, right? So when Rhaenyra's like, well, we don't need you for this specific activity, I was kind of like, yeah, like you kind of don't. Like they make sure like the den of the caves, the dens, everything's okay, that the food supplies rolling in, but I never really thought of them as the primary trainers. So that didn't seem like a real problem for me, although I did remember that scene that we had in season one, the pig scene, right, where they were doing a little bit of training with the princes.
In terms of like other broad categories of scenes, a hefty portion of what we got were scenes of Alicent. How did those work for you? Alicent at King's Landing, Alicent then leaving King's Landing, Alicent then... This is Lee's you-gotta-let-him-cook gesture. Something
your
is
favorite,
up.
Your favorite new gesture on the Mangum Talks Podcast Network, gotta-let-him-cook. It is a gotta-let-him-cook storyline.
It
right?
is.
Because we don't know why Alicent went camping or what that's going to matter or if it's going to...
Why wouldn't she go camping? Camping is fun.
Camping stinks. It's not good.
Quite a bit of fun. Wonderful way
it's
to spend
it. What you do when you can't stay somewhere. Like, by definition, when the world ends, we all camp. Like, but when you can stay in a nice hotel, you stay in the nice hotel. Like, the camping thing never made sense to me.
Sometimes you go camping in places where there aren't nice hotels because you don't want to be near the civilization that's necessary to feed the nice hotels. It's a getting away from it all kind of thing, and that seems to be what Allison's aspiring to here.
Right, but she's proven my point because she wasn't going camping when everything was rosy in the Red Keep. She's going camping now because she's like worried for her person in the Red Keep.
May not be returning, yeah.
It's interesting. It's one of those where I kind of don't want to read any Twitter comments about it because I feel like people are going to make the joke of like Alicent wandered in the woods and like that's super boring or whatever. And it's like, my God, it's a serial show. Like they're doing serial storytelling. Like that they will obviously explain why this is relevant. It will come into play later. Doesn't seem like a show that just won't mention it next episode, although that would be pretty hilarious. So I think we'll learn more next
episode.
Back. I have my thoughts about why she's out there, why that's relevant to the plot, but they're still too spoilery for this bun.
Understood. The other major scenes that we got were Aegon in terms of his healing and recuperation, and I do like how much they have focused on the idea of a kinship forming between Larys and Aegon driven by their shared disability, or similar disabilities, as it were.
They're not using that D word with the king. You notice he said, you're conditioned, or however you are now, or whatever he did.
The king is in a different standing. One must present it in a very...
Standing? Tough.
Didn't mean to do that, but now I'm glad I did. He was standing this episode, which I would have lost a lot of money on, but it's notable that I like that the show did the idea that, yes, some time has passed, yeah, he's standing. But it's not a great idea, and it's against direct medical advice, because from Larry's perspective, he needs a functional king quickly. He needs a king that can walk around. He needs a king that can go about kingly duties. For practical reasons of where he's his means to power, but also because we wait too long, Aemon might just kill him.
Yeah, I think that's a real threat right now. I'm going to give you a chance. So earlier in the season, I talked about how Tom Glenn Carney is clearly the best actor on this show, probably the best actor in America, if not the world right now. Do you want to go ahead and agree with me now after seeing his display, his absolutely epic Shakespearean display here of a man in pain on screen? You want to give Tom Glenn Carney his flowers?
Well, you and I have famously used a 12-point writhing scale in terms of describing how well an actor displays...
It is always 12, yeah. That's true.
Publicly displayed pain. I mean, his screams were on point. I mean, that needs to be recognized, and that gets you some extra credence, as was some aspects of his writhing, invisible pain. I would give, on the 12-point scale, I would give it a solid 9, which I think it was an impressive writhing that we saw. I don't think it rises to the level of Shakespearean, as you suggested. I think there's more work that he could do, but, you know, I will give him his proper laurels.
You know, I can't. When we're judging the folks on this obviously well-established 12-point scale of pain, I don't know if I can give them credit for the yelling anymore. You know, Pedro Pascal not being in the suit for Mandalorian has messed me up with audio. Yeah. Anytime somebody's getting credit,
else.
If I'm getting any credit, like, oh, that actor, that was so great because they were singing. I'm like, well, I don't know. Were they? Because Pedro Pascal wasn't in the
check
suit.
The credits.
So I don't know. Like, don't have any faith in anything anymore. Yeah. All right. Let's see. Anything else that we could talk about this episode? How about this one? What did you think of the actual how Vermithor and Silverwing looked? Like, how did you think about the design of those dragons? How they looked visually?
I love how visually distinct they've made every dragon in this damn show. Of where the dragons have not only distinct colors, but they have a distinct silhouette. Of where you can just see, like, remove even the color and just do a shadow, you can probably have a pretty reasonable guess about what each dragon is. Vermithor, Bronze Fury. He looks a bit like Vhagar. They do similar traits they've now formed of old dragons, of where they've got this long, like, Komodo dragon, like, gullet or jowl thing they've got underneath them that they formed. He's got scars. He looks aged, along with being massive. I like that in terms of that visual depiction. And there's an element as well that done with Vhagar of this is a Godzilla threshold when it comes to the Vermithor appearing on scene. Silverwing, I like how much more clean that dragon was portrayed, of where it is sleek, it is agile, looking through the air, it's an utter beauty. I think it is continuing a trend of the dragons being done beautifully and having their own unique characterization, not only through how they behave on the screen, but also how they visually are displayed on the screen.
I agree with you. I liked Vermithor because Vermithor looked kind of like an old guy. Like a strange, like, dragon like anagram type thing of like it's sort of this strange composite to connect me to the old King Jaehaerys, right? Because it kind of has like the horns around, like that sort of looks that way. That also gives it a distinct look because it has all the horns and the different scales and indentations on its face. I agree with the gullet thing, but it's not as pronounced as Vhagar. Obviously, maybe that's an indication it's not quite as old.
It's an interesting thing with you. I hadn't thought about that with the horns, but it also made for just a perfect visual, which maybe that contributed to the design of when Rhaenyra is now turned and the dragon is perfectly silhouetted behind her. The horns in a perfect, like almost, I wouldn't say heart, but a ring that also surround her as well. It added to that wonderful visual moment of that.
Yeah.
But that was easily my favorite. There were some great scenes of dialogue and character work, but just in terms of well set up scene with a lot of tension, Vermithor wrecking shop and going through the process and terror associated with that was just a very well executed scene, I thought.
I also liked Silverwing because they made Silverwing's wings larger. Just right away, like if you're trying to tell the difference between Silverwing and Seasmoke, which are both blue dragons, I think you can tell right away because Silverwing's a little bit longer and the wingspan is much bigger, just huge. Huge, massive blue wings.
Whose decision was it to go do the joyride over King's Landing, Silver Wings or Ulf's?
See, this is something I wanted to ask you. Do you have any problem with any part of this episode? Like any real like thing that jumps out of you is like, eh. Like this is a real episode 3 moment when Rhaenyra went back to the Red Keep.
It still works well. Yeah. I'm having a bit of a hint from you here that you didn't necessarily like the joyride scene there at the end.
No, that's not it. I promise I'll connect it to what you're saying, but answer the question though. Was there anything that jumped out?
Again, I thought there were some scenes in the early setup. I was a little bit worried about some aspects that they were doing with. No, I don't think there were any scenes that like abjectly pulled me out of it. The scenes that I thought weren't as good or was mentioning decisions, but none that I thought were just like, okay, that just plain doesn't work.
Yeah, fair. So for me, it's the last scene where they're doing almost like the dragon Lord of the Rings shot that we also got in Battle of the Bastards of like the three dragons.
Avengers Assemble.
Yeah. That didn't work for me because the answer to your question, which was whose idea was it to do the joyride, is of course it's Silverwing. And of course, every single thing happening on Vermithor right now is Vermithor's idea. And when having Aemon sort of like chase to Dragonstone and then turn away, like, I don't know if I can handle him. It's like those two dragons have brand new riders. Like, I don't know that. Well, he knows neither one. Yeah, he does. He knows neither one had riders like very recently. He knows they're relatively new riders. It would seem. I'm not necessarily disagreeing with Aemon's decision to turn around, right? He's too important as Prince Regent. He is unsure of what he's going into. My problem is by putting the pieces on the chessboard this way, they're trying to show us that like these three dragons are intimidating to Vhagar and like scary and like potentially could have done something in this situation. But I think that we as viewers know it'd have been a clusterfuck if they had to fight. Rhaenyra doesn't know these two people. The riders have no idea how to ride a dragon. The dragons have been in hibernation for like years. If they got in a throwdown with Vhagar here, it'd been a fucking disaster over Dragonstone.
I think it works for the reason that you said of where Aemon knows none of this, or at least doesn't know enough to take the chance of where. He may have reason to assume that these are basically untrained riders on dragons that haven't been in active service in decades. Fair. But he can't be sure of any of that. Like, he hasn't been put in the loop, which I liked. I liked the scene of where the two advisors are debating whether to tell Aemon on the subject of, hey, there's rumors in the streets that maybe Rhaenyra is getting riders for these dragons. Should we tell him? And they're looking down about two guys that are about to be sent to the wall because they pissed Aemon off.
Oh, those were Aegon's drinking buddies.
They were Aegon's drinking buddies who were instigating or at least also not defusing the riot, not protecting Alicent and Helena. Probably deserved to get their cloaks stripped away. Probably should have never gotten their cloaks in the first place.
That's my problem with sending them to the walls. They shouldn't have had the job to begin with. But whatever.
Their decision to accept. If I was Aemon, I would agree with his decision about, don't you see other dragons just visibly there that you have... did not know until this exact moment had riders, you got to go back, go away and regroup. There's too much of a risk and too much of a chance to commit yourself to a situation that you now are obviously lacking need to know information about.
You're not wrong. You're absolutely not right. As a matter of fact, some might say you're right. How about this? I just don't like arranging the scene that way.
I didn't like that either.
Because it indicates that those dragons are now ready to fight, and they are not.
Plain.
Like, if you wanted to have Aemon come out to get that intel and then go back, he very much could have turned around the second Silverwing got back and saw Vermithor, and you could have heard, like, he could have done a dialogue because he was talking up there anyway. He could have been like, they have Vermithor too? How many more do they have? Something to indicate that why he was turning around was the uncertainty around the situation and not necessarily like any concern for like an immediate battle. I know it sounds like a strange distinction to make, but like these dragons are not ready to fight right now with these new riders. And that point, is not illustrated on screen. And I am fairly certain that like people who watch this show and don't listen to our podcast and don't like just turn it on for 1 hour and then forget it and then come back are going to think those dragons are ready to fight like right now and are going to fight next episode.
The dragons, maybe. The fact they're dragon riders, God, no.
Go ahead.
It's an important thing to note that, and that's part of why this is such a coup for Rhaenyra, is that the basically three new dragons she's added this episode to her side are actually three dragons that have experience. Decades of experience in the case of two of them, immediate combat experience in a recent war in the case of the third. So they are useful dragons in a way that she previously was kind of lacking for her side, because though she had a few dragons, other than Caraxes, none of them have really done much in terms of like active combat experience or even much like lifespan or flight experience. These three do, and that's useful. 100% there with you, though, that dragon is as... A dragon and a rider are a team. They need to both have a certain measure of skill. The dragon can be the most skilled in the world, but if the dragon rider doesn't know what they're doing, that's going to interfere with the dragon's ability to do its job. And so these are incomplete assets 100% in terms of Rhaenyra's camp. But here's actually an interesting question. Do you think Aemon recognized Silverwing flying over? Do you think he recognized Vermithor there waiting on that hill?
Yeah, because of the colors are so distinctive.
Silverwing in particular. Yeah.
The size. Because he, looking at the size of those, he knows there's only two dragons that size. That period, like, you know, that in the realm, like, it's not even just like who, because like both of those dragons are bigger than Caraxes, right? So there's no other dragons in the realm other than Vermithor and Silverwing that are that size. Then you also have the colors.
Of course, you've got to mention the cannibal here. You know,
well, the cannibal, yeah, I mean, the cannibal is likely. I don't know. I'm trying to work in a joke about the internet because he breaks every single rule about this world and canon and meta.
Probably as big as like Silverwing.
Probably on terminally online. Probably an Instagram creator at this point. Probably, you know, on the Starship Enterprise. Yeah. When you were talking, you got to the point through there in what you were saying at the end. There was a question I wanted to ask you, and you kind of, in the way you were explaining it, I think you actually represented that this is kind of a confusing point and a point of like tension in our understanding, which is like when a dragon is fighting, how much of that is the dragon? How much is the rider? How much is the rider necessary? If Vermithor decided, I don't want Hugh anymore, but I do want to just go kick some ass, like how effective would that be? I don't think we have any real idea of that. I think it's a really fun thing to speculate on. I want to do that when, you know, we do the full recap, but I don't think we know, which is why representing that these are all battle ready is just sort of strange to me.
Yeah. Now, just to do a tally before we wrap things up, at this point, basically, Rhaenyra has 9 dragons, effectively, as compared to 2.5, I suppose, for the one and a half, really. Maybe 2, when it comes to the Greens, of where the Greens basically have Vhagar, obviously. Dreamfire is effectively useless because Helen is not riding her. Sunfire's out of commission, and then Tessarion. So it's really just kind of 2, and literally we heard this episode that Tessarion has just now taken to wing. So that's not great. Meanwhile, Rhaenyra's got Syrax, Caraxes, Vermax, Tyraxes, Moondancer, Stormcloud, and now throw in Seasmoke, Vermithor, and Silverwing under arms. That's getting unbalanced, even in a world of where Vhagar's clearly were several dragons.
But you have to whittle that down. I think the list is only...
Some of those were hatchlings. I was purposely trying to pad the numbers.
Right, exactly. So I think the real number, for purposes of like this next episode and next season, is...
Syrax Caraxes.
Is 4.5 to 1.
Well, Syrax Caraxes.
I'm not
including
Caraxes right now.
Caraxes is in independent command at present. Fine. Vermax, we counting Vermax, Jace's dragon?
That's the half.
Half. Moondancer.
You're right, 5.5.
And then it's just a question of what weight we want to assign behind, because we also have Stormcloud and Tyraxes, but they're tiny. And then it's just the weight we want to give to existing dragons with untrained riders for Seasmoke, Vermithor, and Silverwing.
So I'm gonna include them, but like my only caveat is they can't fight the day that they claim the dragon. Like they're going to be able to fight relatively quickly, but it's not like 20 minutes after, you know, they claim the dragon. Like that's the part that's like,
should that be part of like the passage of weeks of when Rhaenyra and Adam were talking on the beach, and she asked, do you think you can make it back to Dragonstone? And he said, I would try. Should we just, you know, make it headcanon that it took him like a week to get back because he had no fucking idea how to get there or how to fly a dragon?
Could. And then we can also, let's keep it going. When Ulf was flying back to Dragonstone, when Silverwing was flying back to Dragonstone.
Ulf was long for the ride.
Ulf with his passenger ticket.
Yeah.
And
coach.
Aemon was chasing. That took a week to get the Dragonstone.
Long ride. Very long ride.
Yeah, that took a week. So that, therefore, Hugh was ready to roll with Vermithor.
Pound for pound, I'm just willing to say that Hugh is ready to roll no matter the occasion from what we've seen of that character so far. Can I start calling him Hugh the Hammer yet?
No.
Did
the show call him Hugh the Hammer?
No, but they should.
I still think you're conflating Book Hugh with the show Hugh, though, because
show Hugh is very distinct.
Yeah, I mean, he was ready to roll this episode, but like up until now, he's been sort of described as a more docile guy, like a family guy. And the only bit of violence we've seen him engage in was to punch somebody for a cabbage. And he seemed like he was feeling pretty guilty after he did that. So he doesn't seem like a hot tempered guy or even somebody who's quick to fight, with justification. He seems like somebody who this is a brand new sort of part of his personality.
100% agree, and it's one of the things I'm fully in acceptance of, that Show Hugh and Book Hugh are just different characters. They share the same name, they're both dragon seeds, but I would find it very surprising if they tried to hew these characters together, given how distinct they've made them so far.
It would be difficult to hew the hues together, I agree.
100% well done.
Very difficult, and that's probably why they're not calling him Hugh the Hammer, because that Hugh the Hammer like connotates like a specific type of personality, like I'm the, you know, like the hammer.
The hammer,
right? And he's not that, so maybe that's why they're never calling him that. Ulf is Ulf the White in the books, and I think that'll work just fine if they want to do that.
Ulf is pretty Ulf. I understand the character.
You know, I said that, but like they purposely showed him without a like very silvery or white hair, so maybe neither one of them are their book names.
We'll find out. There's many things that they can do with these characters now that they've gotten to the point of being dragon riders in Rhaenyra's camp. Dragon lords, dare I say.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how this all progresses, but Rhaenyra has clearly staffed up. She's undergone some recruitment. She's hired for new positions. She's got butts in seats, and she's ready to go. So we'll see. Yeah, we'll see how it all goes. I'm excited to talk through the full recap with you on, I think we're going to do Tuesday this week. So it'll be out Tuesday, but so it'll show up in your podcast feeds on Wednesday morning, and we'll do the full recap. We'll break everything down. May even do a quick few minute spoiler to follow up on our predictions that we did last episode, where we did all spoilers section of the podcast, where we did some predictions about where we thought things were going. That might need to get updated based on this episode going into the finale. That is that's exciting. We'll be doing that on Tuesday. We hope everybody has a great start to their week, and we'll see you then.